Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The world is still mourning the death of 50 adults and children in a terrorist attack on two mosques last Friday in New Zealand. Some were born in New Zealand, while others moved to the country to start a new life. They were Afghans, Palestinians, Pakistanis, Bangladeshis, Egyptians, and Indians. The youngest victim, Mukad Ibrahim, the son of Somali parents, was just 3 years old. The oldest victim is Haji Duad Nabi, a grandfather born in Afghanistan who fled the country in 1979 to escape the Soviet invasion. He was 71 and ran a group called the Afghan Association to help refugees start new lives. New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern made a point to say the names of the victims, not the alleged killer's name. Today in New Zealand, just 6 days after the massacre, she announced a plan to ban all military-style semi-automatic and assault rifles. There are many angles to this tragic story. The alleged killer, a 28-year-old white Australian man, left a long manifesto online in which he praised Donald Trump as a, quote, symbol of renewed white identity and common purpose, end quote. He also referenced Dylann Roof and far-right figures who carried out terrorist attacks in England and Norway. The picture of this global web of white right-wing violence is becoming more clear. From Pittsburgh to Christchurch to Washington, the internet is facilitating the creation of an international community of hate, and social media companies have been very slow to react to their platforms being used as tools by these hate groups. So there are many angles to discuss, and joining us now is A.C. Thompson, a staff reporter for ProPublica. A.C. covers white supremacists and the rise of neo-Nazis. One of his latest pieces for ProPublica is called Despite Crackdowns, White Supremacists and Neo-Nazi Videos Take Stubborn Root on YouTube. And we have had A.C. on several times talking about the frontline documentaries he's worked on this issue. And we will have A.C. in just a couple of minutes. We're also joined by Mustafa Bayoumi, professor of English at Brooklyn College and author of How Does It Feel to be a Problem, Being Young and Arab in America. He's also author of This Muslim American Life, Dispatches from the War on Terror. In a recent Guardian op-ed, Mustafa writes, "Would anyone then be shocked to learn that hate crimes generally have risen since Trump appeared on the national political stage? Nationwide, hate crimes across the board rose by 17% in 2017, according to the FBI, the third year in a row to see an uptick. 2018 numbers are not yet available." Hi, Mustafa. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. Mustafa, I was looking in our archives. We had you on, I think it was 5 years ago, to talk about this very issue. And here we are again talking about this horrific massacre in New Zealand. As I said, Mustafa, there are many angles to take here. What do you think are some of the most important angles to bring to this discussion?
Well, excuse me. I think one of the things that we should be paying attention to is how dangerous it's become to go to a house of worship. I mean, it's really shocking and tragic. I'm not just talking about mosques, but we have the Pittsburgh synagogue shooting. Dylann Roof shot up a church. We have the shooting up of a Sikh temple some years ago. The fact that these places, which are supposed to be sanctuaries of peace, now have to, in fact, employ perhaps armed guards, really is a shocking development to how, we think about our places of worship and where our society is at this moment.
Mm. Right. I was just reading that people in New Zealand are actually guarding the mosque on their own to let people know that we're here for you. Please, we'll try to keep it as safe as possible. I mean, it's actually come to that.
Yeah. In fact, one of my Facebook friends, he's a white gentleman who's a Muslim himself, and he had some time because he was changing planes recently, and he was going, he was in Newark, New Jersey, so he thought he would go and pray the morning prayer in Newark. And so the mosque that he found was an African-American mosque, and immediately he had to undergo a series of questions before they would let him in.
Wow.
Because they were concerned about a white man going to a mosque that they didn't know.
Wow.
And, he wrote in his Facebook post that he completely understands, but this is the place where we're at right now.
Mustafa, you have done a lot of research on this. You've written books about it. And I was just thinking, March 19th, just a couple of days ago, is the 16-year anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. You can go back to 9/11 when, you know, we started hearing and seeing so much Islamophobia in the United States and around the world. Can you talk about that? I mean, going back to what we saw after 9/11 and how that is, and is that connected to what we're seeing today?
Yeah, I mean, you know, right after 9/11, we saw a massive rise in hate crimes directed towards people who are Muslim. I mean, by many accounts, they went up something like 1,800% in the 6 months following 9/11. There were deaths across the country. There was a lot of violence. And there was a mood that was created. I mean, I think most Americans probably thought very little about Muslims within the country prior to 9/11. Nowadays, I think everybody has some kind of opinion about Muslims in America. Mm. And I think, you know, and in fact, it's not just me that thinks that. It's, you know, if you look at the polling data, you'll see that Muslims poll quite negatively. In fact, they poll among the most negative among all the groups in the United States today. And yet the fact is that Muslims are a tiny population in the United States. They're maybe 1% of the U.S. population, yet they occupy an enormous amount of discourse within the U.S. And, you know, what's really happened over the years is that this kind of anti-Muslim sentiment is not just rising, but in fact, I think it's becoming more and more instrumentalized into our very politics. So to the point where, you know, you can actually have political campaigns that are in part based on hatred of Muslims and fear of Muslims. And that, to me, seems also like a very, very dangerous element of our discourse today, not just in the United States, but in fact globally as well.
So when we talk about politicians and racist rhetoric, what really stands out for you? I mean, there's just so much to discuss. BuzzFeed had a story, back in April 2018, state and local Republican officials, this is in the United States, have been bashing Muslims, we count it. This is a piece from Hana Alam, who's since been hired by NPR, and Talal Ansari, and they write that a BuzzFeed news analysis found that Republican officials in 49 states have openly attacked Muslims with words and proposed legislation since 2015, and few have faced repercussions. Mustafa, I mean, you wrote about this in your Guardian op-ed.
Absolutely. I mean, I think this is the political terrain that we're now operating in. And, you know, I mean, it goes all the way to the top. Donald Trump, made a whole lot of political hay out of this idea that Muslims are a threat and should not even be allowed into the country, which, of course, completely ignores American history, because Muslims have been part of American history even before the United States was the United States. But, you know, the fact is that when Donald Trump sits at an interview in 2015 with CNN and says, "I think Islam hates us," he's really defining a fundamental difference that he sees as existing between Muslims, or really Islam, and us. I mean, who is that us? Muslim Americans exist. We exist proudly. We are part of this country. And I, for one, will not be divided in that way. And it just promotes not just fear, it promotes violence. And we've seen it over and over again. We've seen it in Portland. We saw it in Quebec City. We've seen it around the world. And now we see it in New Zealand. And I think it's something that we really need to wake up to.
And
go ahead. Well, I think the other fact of it is that, you know, is that the media culture also generally tends to downplay when Muslims are victims, and tends to promote when Muslims are perpetrators. And so one study found, for example, that when there's an attack where the attacker is assumed to be Muslim, that attack would get around 360% more coverage than if the attack were non-Muslim, were a non-Muslim. And so I think that's also part of the problem here.
And this is really important, Mustafa, because, you know, how do you think the media should deal with this? Medium has a piece called 86 Times Donald Trump Displayed or Promoted Islamophobia. And he started before he ran for president. Just a few examples. September 2010, Trump suggests the United States is at war with Muslims. March 2011, Trump states there's a Muslim problem. April 2011, he doubles down that there's a Muslim problem. He gave an interview to, the Christian Broadcasting Network. And then he made these remarks with Bill O'Reilly on Fox before he was let go for sexual harassment. how do you think the media should deal with this? Because, I mean, we heard on a loop over and over what Trump said about Mexicans when he launched his campaign. What about the rhetoric he uses when it comes to Muslims?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the media has a responsibility here to basically call that rhetoric as bigoted, call it out, and tell its audiences that this is a kind of bigoted rhetoric. We're in a moment right now where we have this strange equivalency where, you know, Donald Trump can say the most outrageous things and then they just get reported as Donald Trump saying outrageous things rather than actually pointing to where the outrage should be in those things. And, you know, I think the fact is that Donald Trump is, you know, some others have said it, he's a kind of troller in chief. I mean, he does not assume the responsibility of what a president should assume, which is, in a sense, to set a kind of, reasonable political tone and draw the lines around what is acceptable discourse and unacceptable discourse. And rather, he just dives right into the unacceptable discourse. And that has repercussions. And I think that the media should be paying attention to how it relays those impermissible things that he says.
Mustafa Bayoumi is professor of English at Brooklyn College and author of How Does It Feel to Be a Problem? Being Young and Arab in America. Mustafa has written two op-eds about the New Zealand massacres for The Guardian and The Nation. You can find those at yourcallradio.org. Now I would like to welcome A.C. Thompson to the show. A.C. is a staff reporter for ProPublica, where he covers white supremacists and the rise of neo-Nazis. A.C. just wrote a piece called Despite Crackdowns, White Supremacists and Neo-Nazi Videos Take Stubborn Root on YouTube. Hi, A.C. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on again.
Well, great to have you back, A.C. We were just talking with Mustafa about the really dangerous rhetoric we hear from politicians. We're just talking about politicians in the United States right now. Donald Trump, but also I mentioned this piece by BuzzFeed, and they found that Republicans in 49 states have openly attacked Muslims since 2015. Can you talk about this, AC? I mean, you spend a lot of time in these chat rooms. In fact, you've interviewed a lot of these white supremacists. How are they affected directly by the rhetoric and these racist statements we hear from politicians in the United States?
You know, I think that's a very, very important question. And I think it's important to understand that for the white supremacist movement in the U.S., Donald J. Trump has been a massive catalyst and a massive source of energy and enthusiasm. And really, this is a sort of phenomenon that social movement theorists will tell you is kind of like the grim mirror image of the 1960s and civil rights. The civil rights movement in the U.S. was energized in part by the knowledge that when you started seeing legislators in Washington, D.C., congressmen and senators, who had sympathy for the concept of black liberation and might actually do something about ensuring the civil rights of African Americans in the country, the movement was energized. It was galvanized. It gained energy. And in the same way, we're seeing that with the white supremacist movement. The white supremacist movement has gained tons of energy, tons of new recruits, tons of new followers, by a sense that there's a president in command in the U.S. who may enact some of their favorite pieces of basically their dream legislation, things that haven't even been dreamed up yet, and somebody that stands with them. So that's like a key thing. If we didn't have Donald Trump, I do not believe we would have such a resurgence in white supremacist movement at this moment.
Wow. Sorry about AC's line, but he's joining us from the doctor. We're going to try to see if we can improve it. Mustafa, what do you think about that? I mean, AC just said if we didn't have Donald Trump, we wouldn't see this rise in white supremacy.
I think there's no question that that's true. I mean, let's take anti-Muslim hate crimes as an example again. And like I was saying, in 2001, they had risen precipitously. But then they fell for several years. They never went back to their pre-9/11 numbers. But then they started to rise precipitously again. And when did they start to rise? They started to rise around 2015, to the point where in 2016, 2017, the number of hate crimes directed towards Muslim Americans actually surpassed what it was was back in 2001. So there's no mistaking the correlation that we have there.
Wow. And what are your thoughts, Mustafa, about just how these white supremacists are affected by Donald Trump? And I mean, AC has worked on two Frontline documentaries about this, and yet I've listened to a lot of media coverage about this massacre, and I'm really not hearing many connections between Donald Trump's rhetoric and these white supremacist movements around the globe.
Well, I think they definitely exist, but they also predate Donald Trump. So I think Donald Trump is, in some ways, he's amplifying something that's already, you know, a kind of toxin that's already in the air. And I think it's important to recognize that, too, because
right.
we have a pre-existing, you know, dangerous white supremacist global movement already. And I think if we looked at just Norway back in 2011, we have the attack from Anders Behring Breivik, where he killed 77 young people because he also felt that Norway was becoming too Muslim, too multicultural. And that precedes, of course, Donald Trump coming to the world stage. So I think it's important not to lay all the blame on Trump, but in fact to understand how Donald Trump is amplifying and in fact seeding, like he's putting the seeds down for a growing movement.
AC, are you seeing this in the national media? Are the national media making the connections?
No, I think maybe not as much as I would like, and I think the point that was just made is absolutely correct. I mean, with white supremacy, what we see in the U.S. is we see a big uptick that goes back to 2008, 2009, with the election of Barack Obama mm-hmm. as first African-American president in the U.S. And you see an uptick there, and you see a slow growth in violent white supremacist activity up to 2015, 2016, and then you see an explosion. So I think that point is a very good one, that, you know, we have seen a resurgence of this movement in the U.S. particularly over 10 years, and Trump ends up being the, you know, sort of the gasoline that really ignites it at the end. I think what concerns me about some of the media coverage, I would say, is there's a lack of understanding that this is a movement that Anders Breivik is a hero for these people. Mm-hmm. Tim McVeigh is a hero for these people. Dylann Roof is a hero for these people. And it is premised on inherently sort of violent ideology. It holds up incredibly violent people as its icons and heroes. But I think even more than that, what's different about this current iteration of the movement, I think there's a thing that the media kind of misses, is that there's a piece of nihilism wrapped in it as well. So if you look at the 80s and 90s white supremacist movement in the U.S., I would say, like, they were violent, they were dangerous, they were cultish in many ways, but this group that we see now is like, they say these kind of things, like the shooter said, like, I want to be the worst killer in the world, I want to kill everyone, I kind of see this school shooter mentality wrapped up with the white supremacist mentality in this current group. It's like nihilistic, misanthropic, and racially hateful and ethnically hateful and hateful towards religious minorities.
And also, can you remind us, AC, what happened when the Obama administration released a very lengthy report about hate and white supremacy in white supremacist movements in the United States? Can you remind us how the conservatives responded to that, and then what happened to that report and the department within the government that was supposed to do something about it?
Yeah, so that was the report that was authored by Daryl Johnson at the Department of Homeland Security back at the dawn of the Obama administration. And basically what Daryl said is, hey, what has happened over the last 10 years is going to happen. He predicted what we're seeing. And he said the conditions are ripe. We have the first African-American president. He is talking about, his concern about guns and about gun safety and the need for restrictions on guns. We have a shattered economy. We have soldiers returning from incredibly traumatic experiences where they have been engaged in wars in predominantly Muslim countries, and they're returning to this shattered economy. He said the conditions are ripe to see a resurgence of far right and white supremacist activity. And what happened at that time is conservative lawmakers hated this and said, you're trashing veterans, and you're trashing Second Amendment bans. The Trump and, or the, at that time, the Obama administration said, oh, yeah, I guess you're right. We went too far here. They retracted the report. Janet Napolitano, who was then chief of DHS, went to the Hill and apologized. And basically, that office that did these sort of forecasts on violent extremism was basically shut down at that point. And I think the lesson there is actually more broad, is that the 80s and 90s, you had the white supremacist movement that was responsible for the Allen Berg murder, was responsible for a series of massive attacks that culminate in the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing. You had a lot of FBI agents at that point who had experience and knowledge of the white supremacist movement and knew how to investigate those groups. After 2001, all that knowledge focused on people that were going to, they believed, would reenact 9/11 style terrorist attacks. And the knowledge base that you had of the white supremacist movement basically dried up within the federal government.
Mustafa, what would you add? I mean, it was very significant that the conservatives came out and slammed this report saying you're going after conservative ideology. And then the Obama administration, I mean, the entire department just disappears. And, you know, that I think that deserves a lot of attention. In fact, the Daily from the New York Times had a great 20-minute segment on it a couple of months ago, just talking about the significance of that department disappearing. Can you talk about the significance of that?
I mean, I think it really shows a kind of cowardice on the part of the Obama administration. And, you know, Obama was so dead set on trying to be a bipartisan president in a situation that where they were not going to work with him at all on so many issues. And in fact, they ended up running the show. And it, you know, to the detriment of the security and the safety of our very country. And now we've just seen that ramped up not just at the political level, but again, at the media level. And so you get Fox News, you know, routinely invoking a kind of anti-Muslim prejudice. You know, the latest example would be Jeanine Pirro and what she was saying about Ilhan Omar. You know, you get these reports that come out routinely as well, and they're looking at what is the level of anti-Muslim sentiment in the United States. What they find is that older Republicans tend to be very much more anti-Muslim than younger Democrats, and older Republicans also tend to watch Fox News a lot more than younger Democrats. And mm-hmm. So they also track a correlation between Fox News watching and anti-Muslim sentiment in the United States. And at the same time, you also have, you know, the Trump administration populating itself with people who are devout in their anti-Muslim sentiments and anti-Muslim feelings. People like, you know, not just Steve Bannon, who's, you know, connected to Breitbart, which is pretty much anti-everything that's not white. But, you know, also Mike Flynn or Sebastian Gorka. You have the Trump administration connected to Bridget Gabriel and Frank Gaffney, who are anti-Muslim ideologues. You have John Bolton and Mike Pompeo, who have also appeared very frequently at anti-Muslim rallies and meetings. And so, you know, it's become a kind of nexus of this force. And in a lot of ways, you know, it bears a connection to the ways in which the Obama administration was unwilling to actually look at this.
Mustafa Bayoumi is professor of English at Brooklyn College and author of How Does It Feel to Be a Problem? Being Young and Arab in America. A.C. Thompson is a staff reporter for ProPublica. Today we are talking about the massacre in New Zealand. Last week, the world is still mourning the deaths of 50 people in an attack on two mosques. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it is our media roundtable, and we will take a deeper look at how the media are covering Islamophobia and the growing threat of white nationalist terror and far-right politics in the United States and across the globe. We will also talk about Brazil's new far-right president and Trump ally Jair Bolsonaro's visit to Washington. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, yourcall@kalw.org. If you'd like to join today's show, what really strikes you about the conversations you're hearing about the latest massacre, this one in New Zealand. If you have any family or friends there, what are you hearing about the community's response? If you're Muslim or from the Middle East, what are you thinking or feeling right now? I just saw some interviews with some young women in New Zealand who said that they are just frightened. They don't want to go to the mosque. They are constantly looking over their shoulders. So what are your thoughts about that? And then if you have any general questions about the rise of white right-wing nationalism around the globe, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. And then the other question is, how do you think we should respond to all of this? You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. A.C. Thompson is a staff reporter for ProPublica who covers white supremacists and the rise of neo-Nazis. Mustafa Bayoumi is professor of English at Brooklyn College, author of This Muslim American Life, Dispatches from the War on Terror, and author of How Does It Feel to Be a Problem, Being Young and Arab in America. I'd like you both to talk about the manifesto. It seems like these killers often leave manifestos. In this case, it was 74 pages long. And in the manifesto, he praised Donald Trump as a symbol of renewed white identity and common purpose. AC, I've been kind of surprised that we're not hearing more of about his references to Donald Trump. But generally, how serious do you think we should take these manifestos? How much time do you think we should be talking about them?
You know, that's a great question, really good question. You know, there's been a lot of discussion in journalism circles and social media in general saying, you know, don't talk about this thing. You're just giving him the shooter what he wants. You're spreading his ideas. And I don't agree with that. I think that's wrong. I think actually for us as journalists, for us as just average people, and also for those of us that study the far right, we need to understand what the motivations of these types of people are and what the organizations are that they may be affiliating with and what the strands of ideology that they're weaving together are. And so I think it's actually very useful and quite important to look at documents like this, and we don't always get them. In the case of the shooter, I think that his description of Donald Trump is actually very, I think it's a widely held sort of view that he's a symbol for the white race, but not a great leader. Mm. And I think with the movement in the U.S. particularly, there was a sense in 2015, 2016 that he would be a great leader. Now he is sort of seen as like, nah, his administration hasn't been great, but we still love the things that he says. He's still the troll in chief. And, you know, he hasn't done what we want, but in terms of being a symbol for white power, he's that guy. But I think what's more interesting in some ways in the document are the ways that the alleged shooter has pulled together fairly arcane strains of white supremacist thought and woven them together. So, for example, he basically is articulating a worldview that's called third positionism, which is basically a variant of fascism that marries together far left ideas and far right ideas. And when I look at the chats and I talk to various white supremacists who are active now, I see this current within them. A lot of them are talking about these kinds of ideas. And these are fairly esoteric branches off the fascism tree from, you know, the 20th century that these guys are going back, they're digging up, they're studying, and then they're having these incredibly complex conversations about them online. And one of the things to note here is I think for a lot of folks, we say, oh, white supremacists, these are a bunch of idiots, these are a bunch of rednecks, they don't know anything. The ideology is so patently and obviously false that they must be dumb. I think that's the wrong attitude to have. Hmm. I think these are very smart young men. Many of them have become very immersed in sophisticated texts, and we underestimate them at our peril.
Mustafa, what are your thoughts on that?
I agree wholeheartedly with what AC was just saying. I think that these people, they think of themselves as intellectuals. They think of themselves as brave intellectuals who are willing to say things that others aren't willing to say. And more importantly, I think that they're using violence as a way to, in fact, promote their ideas. You know, when the shooter before in New Zealand, before he began his rampage, he sent his manifesto to more than 30 parliamentarians in New Zealand. Same thing that we saw with Anders Breivik in Norway, who sent his manifesto to 1,000 people before he began his rampage. In fact, what they're really doing is they're using this extraordinary level of violence, of grim violence, as a way of marketing. They're trying to get their message across. It's more important for them that people read the manifestos than it is for them to actually kill, you know, brutally murder those people that they are murdering.
Mm.
And I think it's a very important point that we should pay attention to.
And it's so chilling to think that this 28-year-old live streamed the entire thing on Facebook.
I mean, I think what we have here is also a connection with our contemporary media landscape, and one that we all participate in. And we have to, rather than just participate, we have to really think about at the same time. You know, anti-Muslim the anti-Muslim blogosphere is essentially a gateway into this fringe right-wing netherworld that we see. And this is based on an article also from BuzzFeed from not too long ago, where they, in fact, were looking at all of the different ways in which these far-right attitudes are present on various blogs. And what they find is that people who begin by visiting the anti-Muslim blogosphere, then they end up finding themselves down that rabbit hole of this hatred.
Wow. And AC, you just wrote about this with a few colleagues at ProPublica. Despite crackdowns, white supremacist and neo-Nazi videos take stubborn root on YouTube. For those of us who have not gone down this rabbit hole and don't really know how this works, can you describe this world that has been created online?
Yeah, and I think like what's concerning, right, is that the social media giants have slowly but eventually started to crack down on these groups. You know, we saw in the 2016 election, we saw millions of anti-Semitic tweets, the vast bulk of them sent out to Jewish journalists or journalists perceived to be Jewish. And really, Twitter at that time did nothing. Fast forward a couple years, and I think you see a lot more action from the social media giants towards, you know, banning these types of, you know, insane white supremacist and neo-Nazi content. However, they are basically losing that battle. So right now I'm looking at Vanguard Streaming Network on YouTube, and their channel page has features two SS lightning bolts, like the Nazis used, features a fasces, which is the axe, it's the symbol of the fascist concept. And a day ago, they were posting videos. 2 days ago, 5 days ago, a week ago. And when you listen to these videos, you know, here's one of them that's talking about how Mein Kampf is a great book. Here's one of them that the host is a guy who calls himself Goebbels. You know, this is really intense neo-Nazi white supremacist content. And there are a ton of these kind of channels on YouTube. You know, you see periodic upsurges on Twitter, on Facebook, on other platforms. But I would say right now, YouTube is one of the platforms that's doing a very bad job at moderating content. And the sort of going down the rabbit hole with this stuff, you know, YouTube now thinks that I'm a crazy neo-Nazi because I look at all this stuff. And so the suggestions I get to, you know, for what I should be looking at more of are Roy Talk, which is another white supremacist show, TRS Radio, which is a radio and streaming network that's run by one of the organizers at the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Red Elephants, which is another white supremacist network, Red Ice TV, which is another white supremacist streaming channel. So you get the push from YouTube, you know, hey, if you check out this Vanguard streaming network with their neo-Nazi stuff, maybe you want to check out these other 20 neo-Nazi or white supremacist channels that are hosted on our platform, and you get deep into the hate very, very quickly.
AC, based on people you've interviewed, how should this hate content be dealt with? Should it be outright banned? I mean, who makes that decision?
You know, that's a great question. For me as a reporter and a researcher, this stuff is very useful. For me as a human being, it's not very useful. And in fact, ProPublica gets discussed on some of these channels at times in very unpleasant ways. I think if I'm running a large company that provides an environment for people to discuss their ideas and post their content, I personally don't think Nazism, fascism, and white supremacy are valid ideas. And I think they're horrible and awful, and they make all the other users feel threatened and disturbed. And so I wouldn't allow these things on my platform. That's, you know, get out of here. That's what I would say if I was responsible for running these social media platforms.
Yeah, well, we definitely have to do a show about this, because I also read that there were copies of the video on Facebook for hours until Facebook finally took it down. I mean, that is just horrendous to think about. So we should do a show about this and have these, try to get these companies on to really answer these questions about why this content is still there. Let's go to a few callers. Let's hear from Nancy in Berkeley. Hi, Nancy. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I was just saying that, thinking that there is a connection between President Obama getting rid of the department because of their report on Muslims in America, and the idea that really none of our great, you know, liberal Congress people are not talking about this. You know, I wrote a long letter to Barbara Lee about Sebastian Gorka, who I consider one of the most dangerous men in America. I never had a reply, but, you know, this horrible massacre in New Zealand is not getting the kind of comments that it should be getting about being tied to Donald Trump. I mean, he said in his manifesto that he considered Donald Trump a mentor, and I haven't heard anybody in the Democratic group say anything about this, and I think it's about time for these liberal Democrats to come out really in support of the Muslims and totally against what Donald Trump has said. I mean, this is terrible that things are being left without really, really strong comments, and also the certain parts of the media, like the New York Times and the New Yorker and CNN and everything. I mean, it's just deplorable.
Well, thank you, Nancy. And Mustafa, as you both said, this obviously did not start with Trump, but he was praised in this manifesto as a symbol of renewed white identity and common purpose. I've been surprised that I haven't heard more about that. What are your thoughts about Nancy's comments and question?
I totally agree. I mean, I think that everybody offers thoughts and prayers, but those are empty words at this point. What we really need is discussions around policy.
Right.
What we really need to is address how we're going to deal with this issue as a collective. And, you know, for one thing, we have a whole bunch of people who are vying for the Democratic nomination for the presidency, and I don't think I've heard any one of them talk about, for example, repealing the Muslim ban as a part of their platforms. And if you can't see the connection between the way Trump is instrumentalized Islamophobia directly into a Muslim ban, then I think we're really in trouble. So I think that that definitely does have to be a much larger part of the Democratic platform has to take account this kind of growing hatred, of which Islamophobia is a big part.
And thanks to Billy for sending us this segment from ABC News, a story from ABC News. A few Fridays ago, Donald Trump told Breitbart News, basically, he's warning that his tough supporters could turn things very bad if provoked by his political opponents. He said, quote, "I can tell you I have the support of the police, the support of the military, the support of the bikers for Trump." And he was asked about how the left is fighting really hard. AC, what are your thoughts about this? I mean, why aren't these comments getting more attention in the national media?
I mean, I think there certainly should be. I think, obviously, there's a certain amount of journalistic fatigue with covering the president's tweets and the president's statements like that. You know, when you look at that, that is obviously it's authoritarian posturing, and we would be, you know, we are lucky that the president is so ineffective that he hasn't been able to effectively reign like an iron-fisted authoritarian. And yeah, so I think these things should absolutely get more coverage. But also, I think the other thing is that we should be looking at what is happening behind the scenes, mm-hmm. what is happening in the executive branch or not happening, and really drill down on that.
He also said, I have the tough people, but they don't play it tough until they go to a certain point, and then it would be very bad, very bad. And Senator Mazie Hirono from Hawaii, a Democrat, in an interview with MSNBC said, I think it's more than an implicit threat. It sounds very much to me like he's encouraging them to engage in something that's probably illegal, such as assaulting people. Well, thank you for that, Billy. I'm glad that you sent that over, because that really needs to be brought into this discussion. And thank you, Nancy, for calling in. Let's go next to Max in Berkeley. Hi, Max. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for taking up my call, and thank you for a good program, as usual. I'll make a very quick comment. I heard from the news last night that they're proposing new laws in New England to really bring under control the circulation of these weapons of destruction, okay? And that they are even proposing, as I understood it, to buy back some of these weapons already in the possession of people out there who love hunting and whatever. This has been done in Australia, and apparently this has had some success in bringing down the level of violence using these sorts of weapons. And I wonder what you think of that proposal in New Zealand.
Well, thank you. I'm just reading from The Guardian here. Officials estimate that there are up to 1.5 million guns in New Zealand, a country of 5 million people. Jacinda Ardern, the prime minister there, she's announced a sweeping plan to ban assault rifles, military-style semi-automatics. She also directed officials to develop a gun buyback scheme for those who own weapons, and this could cost between $100 and $200 million. And there are a lot of articles about what has happened in Australia. Here's a piece from Reuters. The chance of being murdered by a gun in Australia plunged to 0.15 per 100,000 people in 2014, from 0.54 per 100,000 people in 96. That's a decline of 72%. Mustafa, just 6 days after this massacre, we now see that there's going to be a semi-automatic ban in New Zealand.
Yeah, well, that's real leadership, and I think that's what we see from Jacinda Ardern, and I'm so happy to see that. I also think, though, that it's not a panacea, you know, unfortunately. I mean, the New Zealand shooter also, from reports, had bombs in his car that he didn't set off, but he also had bombs. Breivik also, in fact, he began his attack by bombing buildings in downtown Oslo, and then took off and then shot the people on the young people on the island after that. And people are unfortunately able to get weapons, even, you know, illegally. Mm-hmm. And so I think that we're absolutely right. It's rational. It makes complete sense that we should go after, we should have gun control. We should not be having a society that is replete with guns. Absolutely. But at the same time, we can't think of that as a solution if we're not actually addressing the ideological components of the issue that we're talking about.
Yeah. AC, what would you add?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely on point. I think that's a really, really good thing to bring up. And I think, you know, one thing that we want to be looking at is what sort of capacity do law enforcement agencies have at the federal level, state level, local level for dealing with these types of groups and dealing with attacks on mosques, attacks on synagogues, etc. And I think we've seen an uptick in interest, particularly from state and local actors. I've been in touch with people working on behalf of the Governors Association about sort of how they can fend off white extremists. But I don't think that we've seen a ton of leadership at the federal level, and I think that's a thing beyond gun control that we should be asking. We don't want them to create crazy surveillance 1984 state, but we do want them to be aware of what these white supremacist extremists are doing. And we'd rather they intervene before the next attack rather than clean up the horror afterwards.
What can be done about white supremacy in this country, AC?
You know, I think the thing to understand, right, is it's a doomed worldview. It is a cultist worldview, a magical worldview. Like, this, they will not win. That everything is against them. You know, this is becoming a more diverse and more, in many ways, more tolerant and more interconnected country than ever before. But the problem is, as the demographics change and as white folks end up occupying less and less of the demographic space, there are a lot of young white men who are very nervous about that. And they say, look, we see how people of color are treated in the U.S. We see how minorities are treated. And they don't get treated well, and we don't want that to happen to us. And I think we have to be concerned, as those changes happen, that there will be these sort of explosions of anger as that happens. But I think you know, the thing to do is to look straight at that issue and deal with it head on. And, you know, I don't think without having a dialogue about the resurgence of white supremacy, about the honest and real challenges of living in an incredibly diverse country, and about making everyone feel that they're a part of this and that they're not in danger of being disenfranchised and stomped on, or that they are, then we fail.
Mustafa, what would you add?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, it's a difficult question to answer, but I think it's also highly important that we consider the fact that our own history, American history, is steeped in a kind of white supremacy as well. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we are taught that history that way. I mean, I think we're generally taught a kind of triumphalist history of equality and and sharing and all of these sorts of things. But in fact, from the very foundation, it was based on a kind of privilege that was afforded to white people at the expense of other people. And until we confront our own historical past and our own historical demons and look at our own history square on, then I think you're always going to have a subset of white people who think that the loss of their privilege is tantamount to some kind of treason. And that, you know, if you have been privileged throughout your whole life, then equality somehow looks like oppression.
Hmm. Let's go next to Mika in Santa Cruz. Hi, Mika. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi. Go ahead. You're on the air.
I just wanted to point out, I think it's super great that we are examining these violent hate crimes and looking at causes. I just want to point out that for every horrible violent hate crime, there's probably hundreds of ways that prejudice is really disrupting our society here in America. One example is that my cousin, who's Baha'i, she had a falafel restaurant in Bloomington, Indiana, and the state income tax auditor, which of course is a rare position, he went after her and the other three Muslim-oriented businesses in town, forcing the closure of all of them but one. She hired an attorney, and he said, yeah, this is crazy, I've never seen anything like this, but I advise you to just shut down with as little impact as possible. So she contacted the ACLU, and the ACLU said, you know, we're busy with, you know, other hate crimes where people are getting murdered. So I just, you know, I just wanted to make that point because it makes sense. We look at these things allegorically, but also this kind of rampant prejudice, it's just messing up, you know, everything in America. You know, these college students can't eat at that restaurant anymore, and my cousin she moved to Hawaii. You know, it's just, it's a problem that affects so many of us in so many ways.
Thank you, Mika. That's such a good point. Mustafa, what about that? I mean, everyday racism, again, because of the New Zealand massacre, a lot of young people have been interviewed saying, you know, I'm so tired of being stared at, looked at as the other. This is just a regular occurrence in my life. Can you talk about that, the importance of these everyday racism, everyday hate crimes?
I mean, I'll tell you right now that one of the primary anxieties that young Muslim Americans have is just going onto the job market with Muslim names. Oh. Or if you're a woman who wear a hijab, then it's like, then you are immediately considered to be unemployable by many people. And so there's definitely a kind of dailiness to living in the society as a Muslim that's very, very complicated. And, you know, that's something that I think we don't have a good sense of from the general cultural point of view. But yeah, it happens all the time. I mean, there was a period not long ago, in fact, it might still be ongoing, when a lot of banks were closing Muslim accounts just because they didn't want to go through all of, you know, the suspicions that maybe if you had a Muslim name and you had a bank account, that that would be somehow connected to some nefarious activity overseas or things like that. There were all kinds of people who were reporting that banks were just closing their accounts for no reason whatsoever. I mean, these are, in fact, I think this is an excellent call, because these are, in fact, the real ways that that people live their daily lives. They don't live their daily lives worried about getting, or not worried, but they don't live their daily lives actually in shooting situations, but they do live their daily lives worried about where they're going to have a job, or where they're going to live, how their children are going to get ahead, etc.
Is anyone going to stare at them and give them an evil eye on the train? I mean, it's...
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, exactly.
And we don't have much time, but I just feel like, Mustafa, that this is so connected to the so-called global war on terror, because that's when we started hearing... I mean, it's obviously, it goes far back, but that's when we started hearing regularly from politicians this Islamophobia, the things that we saw on television, just the way that Muslims have been portrayed in the media. I mean, it's just, it seems to me that it's just so connected to that so-called global war on terror.
And it's so tragic, because there's no way, just definitionally, how that war can ever end at the same time. So I have no idea how we get out of this circle that we've walked ourselves into.
Mustafa Bayoumi is professor of English at Brooklyn College and author of How Does It Feel to Be a Problem? Being Young and Arab in America and This Muslim American Life, Dispatches from the War on Terror. Mustafa, I hate to end on that point, but... I mean, you're just being honest. I think it'd be great to have maybe a panel of young Muslims on to talk about what they deal with, just what their everyday lives are like, just to continue talking about this.
Absolutely. I mean, if I can make a plug for my book.
Yeah,
I mean,
just briefly.
That's what my, yes, that's what my book is actually about. How Does It Feel to Be a Problem? Where I actually profile, or I have portraits of 7 different young people and what their lives are like after 9/11.
Well, we'd love to have you on, and maybe we can bring on 2 of the people that you profile. That would be great.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
Thank you so much, Mustafa.
Oh, thank you, Rose.
A.C. Thompson is a staff reporter for ProPublica, where he covers white supremacists and the rise of neo-Nazis. A.C., thank you for taking some time from your doctor's appointment to join us. And as always, thank you for your work.
Hey, thank you so much for having me on. Hopefully at some point we'll get to talk about things that are not super depressing.
I know. We would love to have you back on a different topic, but thank you for your important work.
Okay.
Thank you to Andrew Stelzer for producing today's show, Shireen Adel for line producing, and Brianna Gabrielle Martin, our intern. And thanks to Kevin Vance, our studio engineer. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.